Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Frank Wu, a professor and formerly Chancellor and Dean of the University of California Hastings College of the Law, and also Chairman of the Committee of 100, a nonprofit organization promoting good relations between the United States and China. I'll be your moderator for today's program. Nowadays, you can't help but pick up the newspaper and see news headlines about the area known as the South China Sea. Experts suggest that this could be the possible flashpoint of a military confrontation between the United States and its allies on the one hand and China on the other hand. China has asserted claims over most of the South China Sea based on history, including islands approximately 800 miles from the mainland, despite objections from its neighbors, including the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, and Vietnam. Recently, a Hague Court tribunal found that China's territorial claims in the region do not have a legal basis under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Beijing has rejected the jurisdiction of that body and since sent a clear warning to outsiders entering contested areas that they should stay away or face the risk of prosecution. In recent months, Beijing also has reacted angrily to United States and Australian freedom of navigation operations in that area. They've scrambled fighter jets and sent naval boats and denounced the other nations as threatening Chinese sovereignty. To provide a knowledgeable expert perspective on all of this and potential remedies, I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest, Bill Hayton, BBC correspondent and author of the book, The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. This book was named as one of the Economist's Books of the Year in 2014. Mr. Hayton has worked for BBC News since 1998 and served as its reporter in Vietnam from 2006 to 2007. He also spent 2013 embedded with Myanmar's state broadcast media working on reform. He's an associate fellow with the Asia Program of the Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, based in London. He's given presentations on the South China Sea and Southeast Asian issues for think tanks and government institutions around the world, including in the UK, the US, Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, and Vietnam. And his written work has been published in The Economist, The South China Morning Post, The Diplomat, and The National Interest. Please join me in welcoming Bill Hayton.
Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great honor to be here, and I'm very aware what a great distinguished list of speakers the club has, and I'm really happy to be part of it, and thank you for that kind introduction. Two disclaimers. First of all, I'm dressed because I've just finished a three-week holiday in the United States. I usually have a jacket, but I didn't bring one with me this time. The other is that although I do work for the BBC, I need to point out that, you know, just like the United States government, the BBC takes no position on the territorial disputes in the South China Sea. This is all my own thinking. And I also want people to be aware that I didn't do all of this research myself, that I relied on an awful lot of other people, and want to give thanks to some of their research as well. Now, the South China Sea could be quite an obscure part of the world for many people because it's a place which doesn't have any inhabitants in its natural state in the center of the sea. Obviously, around its coasts, there are hundreds of millions of people that live there. They depend upon the fish supplies from the sea. They depend upon the trade that goes across it. And to some extent, they depend on the oil and natural gas resources. But I always say there are two sets of disputes in the South China Sea. There are disputes about the islands and the reefs and the rocks in the sea. These are territorial disputes, and they involve the countries around the borders of the sea: China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, to some extent Indonesia as well. And when we talk about China, obviously we can talk about two Chinas. There are also disputes about the spaces in between the islands, the spaces about whose rules rule what happens in between the islands. And those disputes are really between China and the U.S. for the main part. But as Professor Wu was alluding, this recent tribunal ruling from The Hague also addressed that part of the dispute. So there are two sets of disputes, and the danger for me is when these disputes overlap, when questions about who owns which island become mixed up with questions about whose rules rule in Asia. Now, the actual islands we're talking about are tiny. Some of them you can just about fit a runway on. Some of them, the runway, these are the largest natural islands. The runway sticks off the side in the case of the Philippines' largest possession, T2, known in the Philippines as Pagasa. The smallest islands are barely, or reefs or rocks, are barely big enough to stand on in their natural state. What's happened is, these are basically coral reefs with in a few places that with rocks that stick up above the surface. But as you will probably be aware, in the last 2 or 3 years, China has, in particular, has added millions of tons of steel and concrete to some of these reefs, and in three cases built runways on them, and in four other cases has built substantially larger bases. These are in the Spratly Islands in the southern part of the South China Sea. China also occupies the Paracel Islands in the northern part of the South China Sea, which are larger generally in size. And that part of the dispute is really only between China and Vietnam over the Paracel Islands. Now, in terms of the actual shape of the dispute, one of the key factors in this is what's I tend to call the U-shaped line. Some people call it the nine-dash line, but the number of dashes has changed over time. So I tend to call it the U-shaped line just for consistency. It first appeared on a Chinese map published on a Chinese map in 1948. In this talk today, I'll try to show you how this line came to be drawn and give you some background to the origins of the Chinese claim. But there's still a question really about what China means by this line, and I would say that the meaning of the line has changed over time in the last century since it started to be drawn by different people. Now, China claims as its southernmost territory a very strange place, a place called the James Shoal, known in Chinese as the Zhengmu Ansha. But when you go to the James Shoal, if you ever go, as Chinese flotillas do from time to time, for example, when they're going on their anti-piracy missions off Somalia, they stop by the James Shoal, but there's absolutely nothing there. It's just a piece of empty sea. The nearest piece of land is, in fact, 22 meters below sea level. So the weird question is, why did China choose a non-existent island to be its southernmost piece of territory? And in trying to answer that question for the book that I wrote, I think I managed to unlock the history of the U-shaped line, the history of China's claim in the South China Sea. Now, the James Shoal is a very, very long way away from the Chinese mainland. It's just about 100 kilometers off the coast of Borneo, about 1,500 kilometers away from the coast of China proper, if you like. It's in no way part of China's continental shelf. The sea in between China, the Chinese mainland, and the James Shoal is in some places 5,000 feet deep. So it's not part of a Chinese landmass by any modern definition. China asserts that it has an ancient claim that it has occupied, administered the islands in its quotes, in its words, since ancient times. But a more detailed look at the regional history of the South China Sea, looking at different perspectives from different parts of the South China Sea, from different coastlines, shows a much more complex view, in my view. So, for example, one can go back and look at some archaeological evidence, and I went to Palawan in the Philippines and to a very beautiful place called El Nido in the northern part of Palawan. And there's been an archaeological dig, and they've managed to find at the base of some limestone towers, very dramatic limestone towers, a burial. This is a burial that's 5,000 years old. And the archaeologists at the University of the Philippines have discovered that this burial was in the shape of a boat. That it's actually been the actual burial was constructed in the shape of a boat. And the person who was buried with baler shells, which are used by traditional peoples to bail out their boats, and with beads and shells, which came from the other side of the South China Sea. Places like Vietnam and what's now Malaysia, Indonesia. This is 5,000 years ago. There are indigenous people navigating around the South China Sea. And these are people who wouldn't know what China was or Philippines were or any of these modern categories. These are traditional sea gypsies in some places. In the Philippines, you can find them still referred to as Bajau. The same word is used in Malaysia, or Orang Laut in Indonesia, sea people. And so here you have in China, you have maritime people. The slide... I also have pictures of people in this case, in Burma, in Myanmar. You find maritime peoples living all around the region. And as late as the 1950s, 60s, you could find people who never went on the land, who had never in their entire lives been on land. They'd always lived in sea, these sea gypsy people. These were the people, these are the indigenous original inhabitants of the South China Sea. You find them all around the coast of the South China Sea, even now to some extent. In the early centuries of Common Era, sort of AD, you find records of Arab and Persian navigators traveling from the Middle East to China. You find there's a mosque in Guangzhou, which has been there since the 8th or the 9th century. You find references in Chinese texts to relations and massacres even of Arab and Persian traders. So trading has always been a very international aspect of the South China Sea history. You find Southeast Asian civilizations, states, kingdoms, principalities, whatever, with a very long history in the South China Sea, all of which were trading, all of which managed to monopolize aspects of trade in the South China Sea, going back 2,000 years in different places. And you can see evidence, for example, on the sculptures, on the etchings in Borobudur in Indonesia of boats that used to sail across the South China Sea. And even if you look at the actual detail of how boats are constructed, you can see how ideas moved around the region, you know, that Chinese ships would adopt Southeast Asian ideas and vice versa. But one of the most common elements of this is that the actual islands in the central part of the South China Sea were not seen as a prize to be occupied or used. They were seen as a hazard to be avoided. So really the only people that were able to go into the dangerous parts of the South China Sea, where the rocks and the reefs are, were these traditional people, the people that had built up generations of knowledge. As far as traders and modern ships were using, they were trying to avoid these parts of the South China Sea. And even going back to the time, you may have heard of the Chinese diplomat Zheng He, about 600 years ago, 1400, 1430, that sort of time. The maps that he left behind and the navigational instructions, he basically was telling his, these are navigation instructions to avoid the islands in the South China Sea. These are threats to shipping. When you don't know exactly where you are, where you can't control your direction, you're at the mercy of the wind and the waves, you try to avoid the islands. Another map, a few years ago, a map was discovered at Oxford, in a library in Oxford in the United Kingdom. This was a map that was drawn up in the early 17th century by Chinese merchants. And this map shows a network of trading routes around the region. So showing how, even at a time when we used to think that China was very much closed off to the outside world, that trading was in fact continuing in coastal provinces. But it shows a China connected to the region, but not a China that's occupying islands. It's a trading system which avoids the islands. Because if you want to trade, you don't want to go to deserted islands in the middle of the sea. You want to go to places like Manila and Hanoi and whatever around the outside of the sea where people will buy and sell things. So these old maps don't really tell us very much about who owns the South China Sea. They just tell us bits about who went to different places. And what's fascinating to me is that traditional local ideas about where islands were and where the navigational threats were passed from people who lived in the region, Chinese, Malay, Vietnamese, whatever, to the Europeans when they arrived in the 16th century. And so you see on maps over the last, well, certainly from sort of 1600 to 1800 or so, you find non-existent islands, a great chain of them marked in the South China Sea. And if you look at any map drawn in the sort of 17th, 18th centuries of the South China Sea, you will see a chain of, often drawn in the shape of a sail, of islands along the coast of Vietnam, which was believed to exist, which doesn't in fact exist. And this belief that these islands were there and were an impenetrable threat prevented people from sailing directly from what's now Singapore to China, because they felt they had to hug the coasts. So these ideas about where islands were very vague. No one really administered or occupied them. We even, to some extent, knew where they were, at least until, basically, well, I mean, it was the British that mapped them. And in fact, it was the British that actually first stuck a flag in one of the islands and said, you know, do you know the Eddie Izzard quote? You know, kind of, but have you got a flag? In 1877, it was the British that first stuck a flag in an island and said, this is ours. Up until that point, no one really cared about who owned the islands. So it was only the beginning of the 19th century that they were even first mapped. And as late as the end of the 19th century, you still have great bands of pirates roaming the South China Sea, interfering with navigation, and in this case, the famous case, the pirates that hijacked a ship called the Nomoa were executed in 1891. But as late as 1897, a Chinese map of southern China, of Hainan Island and the coast, doesn't show any islands further south than Hainan. They weren't considered significant to Chinese administrators. But something changes very dramatically between 1897, when this map, and 10 or 12 years later. And the background, of course, is the idea that China was being humiliated by the foreign powers, by the British, by the French, by Russians, by Japan, carving up the country into spheres of influence. And really, China's interest in the South China Sea, and I'm still working on this particular episode, is triggered in early 1909 when a Japanese merchant is digging up guano, bird poo, from the island of Pratas, which is between Hong Kong and Taiwan. And this provokes a major angry reaction in China. As a result, the Japanese government concedes sovereignty over Pratas to China, and the Chinese government pays the Japanese merchants an awful lot of money, 130,000 silver dollars, for him to leave Pratas. And this is the beginning, this is the very first time, 1909, that you see a Chinese claim emerge to the South China Sea Islands. And at this stage, it's only to the Paracel Islands. It's nothing to do with the Spratlys at all. And this is all part of an anxiety in China about where its borders should rightfully belong. Because China at this stage, the 1911 revolution, a modern republic emerges from the old empire. But then the modern republic is aware that territory has been stolen from it by the French, the British, the Russians, the Japanese, and doesn't know whether to claim the territory it has now or some wider amount of territory. So the very first map that the Chinese government produces in 1912 doesn't show any borders, which is a kind of crazy thing when you think about it. We're used to countries having borders and edges. That's what defines them. But in China, they didn't know where the rightful boundaries were. And so you see maps with references to formerly our vassals. So Vietnam and Korea, you know, they've been taken by other powers. Should they rightfully still belong to China? And this discussion still goes on. And in fact, I think you can see that, I think even in the modern Taiwan Constitution, the Republic of China Constitution, I think it still says that the territory of the boundary, you know, is the same as the territory of the empire, but it doesn't actually define what that territory is. And so you get a lot of private individuals trying to make maps to show where China's rightful territory should belong. And you find a sort of whole private industry. These are not state officials. These are private geographers or activists or nationalists trying to define the edge of China and printing maps that show boundaries where China's rightful, you know, where China is now and where these people think China should be, really. And this is happening throughout the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. And really, the South China, this is where the South China Sea dispute becomes more complex. Because at the same time, Japan is getting in on the act. Its merchants are trying to extract more guano before fertilizer for the field, the rice fields back home. So the Japanese are getting involved. That's prompting concerns from some of the Chinese about Japan's involvement. It's also prompting concerns from France, because France is the colonial power in Indochina. So the French are now worried about what Japan is up to, so they start to claim the islands. And so in the 1930s, in 1933, I'm cutting a long story quite short here, I should point out, France annexes six of the Spratly Islands in 1933. And this provokes a massive reaction in China, demonstrations in the streets, articles in the newspapers, this kind of thing. But what becomes very clear is that the Chinese government, there's a Chinese government in Nanjing, it doesn't know where the islands are. And so it has to ask its diplomats abroad, particularly in Manila, for a map from the Americans to show them which islands the French have annexed. And once they realize that it's not the Paracel Islands, they kind of relax. But there's a separate rival government down in the southwest of China, which is not convinced and continues to agitate about the fate of the islands. This is the French stick their advert in the newspaper saying they've annexed the islands in July 1933. And in response to this sort of confusion in China about the islands and where they rightfully are, the Chinese government has a committee to try and regularize its maps, to try and answer these questions about where China's boundary ends. And the committee starts to begin its meetings in almost exactly the same time as the French annex the islands. But I think that's just a coincidence from what I can work out. And then in 1935, they produce a list of island names. So they've actually tried to regularize the names of the islands in the South China Sea. But what's interesting at this point is that some of the islands, some of them have Chinese names. So for example, Subi Reef, for example, seems to have a Chinese root. But many of the names that the Chinese government gives them are simply translations or transliterations of the English names. So, for example, Beixian in Chinese is simply North Danger, the English name translated. Spratly Island, named after a British captain, Richard Spratly, becomes transliterated as Siba La Tuo, just the transliteration of his name. Antelope Reef is named after the ship that surveyed it, Lin Yangjiao. It just means antelope. My favorite is it's still now Chinese. One of the Paracel Islands is Jinjindao, which is Money Island, which is money, you know, notes and coins. Actually, it's William Taylor Money, who was a manager of the East India Company. He was the reason why that island has that particular name. And by comparing the list of names, what's interesting is that the Chinese committee gives some names to features that don't actually exist, because there were many mistakes on the early maps. And just by comparing different documents, I've been able to work out that the Chinese list actually came from a British publication from 1906, the China Sea Directory. They copied out the list of names from here and gave them Chinese names. And this is the point at which the James Shoal, the southernmost point of Chinese territory, becomes the southernmost point of Chinese territory, because they translate James, Zengmu, simply the transliteration of James, J-M, but they don't really know how to translate the word shoal, because shoal in English means shallow, but they translate it in their list using the Chinese word tan, which means sandbank. And so they define what is in fact a piece of shallow water as an island. And at this point, the confusion kicks in, and you see the name is marked on a map which the committee publishes later in 1935. And why did they give these underwater features particular prominence? I think it's because they copied another British document. They copied a map that was published in London in 1918 by the Stanford Company of London, which also gives particular prominence to the James Shoal and also to the Vanguard Bank. And so, at this point, I don't think China has actually claimed these features for itself. But I think what happens in the subsequent decade is that you get more confusion about exactly what China is going to claim in the South China Sea. And I think a belief, by the end of the Second World War, people are referring to what happened in the 1930s with a kind of a false memory, if you like, that what happened in the 1930s isn't remembered correctly. And at the end of the Second World War, China believes that it asserted a claim back in 1933. Obviously, this is a time of enormous chaos in China and the region. In the 1930s, you've got internal fighting, you've got the Japanese invasion, you've got the Second World War. But a lot of people are trying to sort of regularize China's position in the world. A lot of them are private individuals. For example, a geographer, one of the founders of the China Geographical Society, Bai Mei Chu, was a key figure. And it's him that publishes an atlas in 1936. And for the very first time on a Chinese document, remember this is a private document, not an official one, it's an atlas produced by a private company, you see the James Shoal marked inside a U-shaped line for the very first time that stretches down here. So this is the time you see the U-shaped line, 1936, but it's not yet a government document. It's worth pointing out that during the Second World War, the Allies, including Chiang Kai-shek from the Chinese side, discussed the fate of Japanese-occupied territories. But there's a very sneaky, if from a Chinese perspective, distinction here between some specific places which the Allies say will be returned to China, particularly Manchuria, northeastern China, Formosa, Taiwan, and Pescador, the islands immediately off the coast of Taiwan. And then there's a new sentence, and it just says, Japan will also be expelled from other territories, but doesn't say who those territories are going to be given to. And China, still now, you see Chinese officials saying, but the Cairo Declaration promised us the Paracels and the Spratly Islands. It didn't. Okay, there's a full stop and a new sentence. You know, this rather subtle distinction, which was presumably done that way because the French had their own interests in the Paracels and the Spratlys and didn't want them to be given to China at the end of the Second World War. The islands are attacked by US and other forces during the Second World War. But then immediately after the Second World War, a professor, another geography professor, who's actually a student of Bai Mei Chu, the guy who drew the line back in 1936, is hired by the Chinese government to basically settle the argument about China's maps and where the country should begin and end. And he goes on a voyage. And in 1946, they get ready to voyage down to the bottom of the South China Sea, partly prompted because the Philippines has just become independent, and fairly soon afterwards, the Philippines foreign secretary says that the Philippines has a claim to the islands, and that prompts a Chinese voyage. And this document from the Taiwan archives shows the very first time, I think, that you see the origin of the U-shaped line on an official Chinese government document in produced for a meeting in September 1946. So, and then again, the language confusions continue. The very first time that any Chinese official lands in the Spratly Islands, as far as I can work out, is the 12th of December 1946. So this is, you know, it's not ancient times, it's 12th of December 1946. And at the same, this is a time of great competition, not only between the Philippines' claims and China, but mainly because of the French and the Chinese are going head-to-head. The Chinese are able to mount this expedition in 1946 to the Paracels and the Spratlys because they receive ships from the U.S. Navy, and their crews have just been trained in Miami as part of the U.S. aid to China during and after the Second World War. So they're able to mount this expedition. So the very first time you see the U-shaped line published on a Chinese map is in 1948, and it emerges from these confusions about language, and you see even at this point there are mistakes on this official map in terms of the actual Chinese transliteration of James and so forth. So the U-shaped line, really, I would say, emerges in a very haphazard way. It's quite an accidental process. It involves a bit of misunderstanding, a bit of mistranslation here, and was shaped by the geopolitical realities of the 1930s and the 1940s. Unfortunately, it's the legacy that we're left with today. Some of you may be surprised to hear this, but you know, I imagine that people in China will be even more surprised to discover this rather hidden history of it. And the problem is that the myth that's believed by, let's say, a billion people is that these islands have all been Chinese since ancient times. But obviously, other people around the region have very different understandings of the history of the region. And you know, that's really what we're locked into, is that these different understandings of the history. I think they can be resolved if people are willing to listen to different points of view and different bits of evidence. The question is, are they willing to do so? And the more the geopolitical context, particularly in the US and China, becomes agitated, the more difficult it is, I think, for evidence and reason to have a part in this debate. Now, I'm very aware that I've only barely mentioned the Philippines claim. I've said nothing at all really about the Vietnamese claims, but I am sort of on time, you know, running out of time here. I'm very happy to talk about that. I'm very happy to talk about sort of current situation in the South China Sea and regional politics and that kind of thing. But I thought you would just might find that background interesting to kind of set the scene for our discussions.
Our thanks to Bill Hayton, BBC correspondent and author of the book, The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. It is now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions already, so let's begin. A reminder for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is BBC correspondent Bill Hayton, who is discussing the tensions between the United States and Western allies and China in the South China Sea. I'm Frank Wu, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on the internet through Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Let's turn now to audience questions, and if you do have questions, please feel free to fill out a card and give it to one of the volunteers at the side of the room. Let's start, Bill, with the title of your book, The Struggle for Power, the subtitle. How does this particular set of issues connect with broader concerns about the rise of China or the rise of the East, the decline of the West, the possibility that the United States will be challenged for its superpower role?
I think that's the reason why we take an interest in this. I mean, these disputes have been around for a while, but if it wasn't for the bigger picture, we wouldn't think they were that important. I mean, I think that let's take the United States' view on this. I think, you know, it has, let's say, three main interests in the South China Sea. The most important one is in terms of access, in terms of the movement of trade, but also military vessels through the South China Sea. I mean, the U.S. needs to, as long as it continues to regard the Middle East and Persian Gulf as important, you know, it will need to be able to supply troops and it will need to be able to guarantee the flow of trade. The big figure is $5 trillion of trade goes through the South China Sea each year. I haven't counted every dollar, but I mean, that's a kind of a commonly quoted figure. Another is the security of its allies in the region. The Philippines is a treaty ally, Thailand, Taiwan is obviously important to the US, Australia, New Zealand, Japan. These are all, you know, important treaty allies of the United States. And I think ultimately it's about the fate of the international system. Do the current rules work for everybody? Are they going to endure? Does the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, does that apply everywhere? Does international law apply everywhere? Is it okay for China to say, we don't like the way this rule is interpreted or affects our interests, we want to kind of to change it? And so you end up with a kind of situation where actually, and I agree with when you hear American administration officials say, it's not about the rocks, it's about the rules. It's about, and the U.S. has been neutral about who owns which islands, genuinely neutral. I mean, it stood aside in 74 when its ally, the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, lost the Paracel Islands to China. It stood aside in 88 when China took over some of the Spratly Islands. It didn't intervene in 94 when, in effect, the Philippines, again a treaty ally, lost Mischief Reef to China. So the U.S. has been genuinely neutral over a long period about who controls which island. But on the question of what happens in between the islands, you know, access, freedom of navigation, it's absolutely, you know, kind of, you know, that's where the U.S.'s interest is. And obviously, once you start to take that into account, then which country is on which side, which country is stronger, which countries are going to stand up to China, et cetera, then all those things kind of flow from that.
Much has been made of the Chinese view of the relevant treaties and the authority of the Hague Court. What about the United States and its acceptance of these treaties and the jurisdiction of the court?
This is the big problem of legitimacy that the U.S. faces. when it comes to talk about Southeast Asia and South China Sea is, but there is the Law of the Sea Convention took 9 years to negotiate between 1973 and 1982, and almost every country in the world has both signed and ratified it. And the United States has not ratified it yet. Even China has ratified it, and it's a big problem because, you know, whenever the US stands up and sort of tells China, you know, kind of you should abide by the Law of the Sea, well, China can just turn around and say, well, you haven't even ratified it. At which point, the US turns around and says, okay, we haven't ratified it, but we always follow it. You know, the US Navy kind of accepts it and da-da-da-da-da, you know. But it would, and basically there are 34 senators who have signed a letter saying that they will never ratify the Law of the Sea Convention. And of course, you know, the Constitution better than I, 34 is a blocking minority. In November, if, you know, a couple of those people lose their seats, then maybe the US might find a way to ratify the convention. The convention is important because that's what the Philippines legal case was based on. And there's somebody in this room, I don't know if he wants to identify himself, who is the brains behind this legal case, who knows far more than I, but I will try and do the best I can. It's a very, very clever legal case. It avoided all questions of sovereignty over who is the rightful owner of which island or reef. It was simply saying, okay, this is a rock. It sticks up above the water at high tide. That means it gets a 12 nautical mile territorial sea around it, according to UNCLOS, according to the Law of the Sea Convention. Okay, if this rock or island can support human habitation, it gets not just this 12 nautical mile, but it gets a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone that goes all the way around it. It's not territory, but the country that owns the island gets to control all the fish and the oil around it. And what this the case argued was that none of the features in the Spratly Islands or Scarborough Shoal were proper islands, so none of them get the 200 nautical mile. At best, they get the 12 nautical mile. So rather than saying that China can basically draw a big line and say we can control all the resources inside this U-shaped line, it says basically, no, you can control that circle there, that circle there, that circle there, that circle there. We don't know who owns these islands, but as long as we stay outside these 12 nautical mile circles, we can drill for gas or we can fish or whatever in the areas around there. And the court, sorry, it's not a court, it's a tribunal, basically said on pretty much every one of the 15 points, we agree. And China lost on those 15 points. Now, that says nothing at all about who is the rightful owner of which island. So China can continue to insist that it's the rightful owner of every feature in the South China Sea, but it can't now say that it has the rights to all the fish and all the oil within its U-shaped line. That's the key factor.
These are all wonderful questions, so please continue submitting them. This question is, obviously the South China Sea has the potential for war, but what is your view about China claiming Siberia and having conflict with Russia?
Well, I mean, in theory, I mean, these territorial questions are open in some people's minds. I mean, the difference is that, I mean, China has a massive land border and pretty large maritime borders as well. And what I find interesting is that in every case, except two spots on the Indian-Chinese border, China has managed to settle its land borders all the way around. I mean, and they have the similar disputed history. I mean, you know, the maps of national humiliation that were drawn in the 20s and the 30s, these were claiming areas of Russia and as far away as Afghanistan and places as being rightfully being Chinese, because in the past, these places used to send tribute to the Chinese emperor, and they that might have considered themselves to be part of the Chinese sphere of influence. But throughout the 20th century, China made compromises and deals and settled all of its land borders, even with Vietnam, with whom it fought a war in 1979. That land border is now settled. But on all three of its maritime frontiers, China is in dispute. And it's an interesting point, you know, kind of with Korea, with Japan, and in the South China Sea. And I think the difference is that on land, there were other states that pushed back. And there were governments to agree a boundary with, and you know that was necessary for trade or whatever. Whereas in the maritime sphere, there was no one to push back. Sea is different. You can't permanently occupy it. You can't stick a fence around it. And so China was able to continue to dream that it was the rightful owner. And we, you know, before the internet, before satellites, all this kind of stuff, you didn't know who was fishing where. and it didn't really matter. But the Chinese dream about the maritime boundary persisted at the same time as Vietnam was kind of leasing off in bits of the seabed to oil companies, and Malaysia and Brunei and Philippines were doing the same thing. And so, you know, the period at which the maritime boundary should have been fixed, which was, you know, 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't. And it's just, you know, we've now got a much bigger problem. But you're right. I mean, you know, Russians are, I think, a little bit worried about, you know, kind of the depopulation of eastern Russia and the fact that there's an awful lot of people that would like some, you know, extra, you know, agricultural land or whatever to kind of just hit the site. And so that might be when people from the US and Europe look at China and Russia and sort of see them pairing up to kind of thwart US interest in the region, there are also plenty of issues between the US and China that need to be sorted out, not least, for example, how much China is prepared to pay for Russian gas. You know, these kind of things are quite big disputes between the two.
We have a number of questions about the possibility of military conflict arising. What is your assessment of the likelihood of military conflict between the US and China? And who are the persons in the government or active in U.S. politics who are pushing the notion that China is enemy number one?
I do think that there are sensible people in charge of government policy, well, at least until November, anyway. You know, and that everybody realizes that a war in the South China Sea would be very bad for everybody, that no one's going to win. The problem is that if you want to intimidate or threaten or in a kind of, in some way, diplomatically signal your intentions, we're now in a stage where you have to kind of, in a way, prove that you're willing to do something completely irrational in order to show that you have the resolve to see this through. So, for example, the Scarborough Shoal is a tiny reef off about 100 or so miles off the coast of the main island of the Philippines. No one can live there. It's just about big enough to stand on. But this has been this year in the last 6 months the front line between the US and China, really in the South China Sea. And from what I can understand from things that come out of Washington, is that the US has basically said to China, if you attempt to build a runway on the Scarborough Shoal, we will sink your ships. And this has been done very quietly and diplomatically, but the US has had a naval vessel on station near the South China Sea pretty much continuously. It deployed A-10 attack aircraft to the Philippines to kind of show, you know, these are the kind of planes that could, you know, shoot up a dredging barge quite easily. So these things are not being done in a kind of big grandstanding way, but they are being done. So the question is, for the time being, China has backed off. But what happens if, you know, a different set of circumstances come and China says, well, we don't really think that the US is serious about this anymore. Perhaps we'll try it. And at that point, you end up with a whole series of if the U.S. lets China do this, what does it say about the U.S.'s position in the world? Does the U.S. then have to come back even stronger to kind of show that it's still a power in Asia? Does it have to do something more dramatic than that? Do we end up on a slippery slope towards confrontation? And I think the problem is that, you know, China has this belief, you know, generated by this century of making history about the South China Sea, that these islands are rightfully theirs. It sees the other countries' interventions as being illegitimate, imperialistic, or simply wrong, and has a sense of sort of righteousness about its actions. And I don't think that China's going to stop. Some people call it salami slicing, small steps that, you know, won't provoke a reaction with the idea of getting to a bigger destination. So what is actually going to stop China, and how is China going to be made content with the status quo? Because the status quo is not such a bad thing, all the different countries around occupy a few of the different islands. There isn't a war. Most of the countries can extract the oil and the fish and whatever. I mean, the fish is a big problem because the countries can't even agree to work together to count the fish. So we've got no idea what the fish stocks are, and they're probably in a state of catastrophic decline, but we can't do anything about it. China has perfectly sensible fishing ban in the northern part of the sea for 3 months a year. They say, right, April, May, June, I think it is, you can't do any fishing in the northern part of the South China Sea. But the other countries won't recognize it, because if they recognize it, they think that will somehow legitimize China's control in the South China Sea. So Philippines and Vietnam send their ships deliberately to go and violate, at least Vietnam does, to deliberately go and violate the fishing ban just to prove that they don't recognize the Chinese fishing ban. Whereas, in fact, a fishing ban would be a perfectly sensible thing to institute, you know, during the breeding season or whatever. So, yeah, so the point is, the status quo is not such a bad situation. And if everybody could recognize it and agree not to push anybody else off the other islands and features, that would be great. And the Southeast Asian claimants have more or less done that. Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, in effect, have an informal understanding that that's the case. And we just need China to sort of sign on to it. But China believes that the other countries are illegitimately occupying theirs. And so they're going to continue to keep pushing in some ways. They're going to continue to say, these are Chinese fish, this is Chinese oil, all the rest of it. What is going to persuade China? Does it need some kind of grand diplomatic bargain, you know, kind of where the US and China basically kind of agree to recognize each other's interests and maintain the status quo? I think that's something on those lines is needed, but exactly how you do it, I'm not sure.
You've mentioned navigation and trade, as well as fish and oil. This question follows up. Other than national pride, what are the motives for China and the Philippines? What are their interests in this area?
I think national pride, or at least the sense that this space, these islands, whatever, is rightfully Chinese, is critically important. I think it underpins everything else. Because when someone talks about oil or whatever, there's a sense that this is our oil that's being stolen by some other country, or gas or fish or whatever the issue is. But I also think it's very important, I mean, that Chinese policy, and I mean, I'm not a China expert really, Chinese policy is not monolithic. Okay, there's a Communist Party which decides what the policy is, and that filters down, but it's usually written in such vague ways that it can be interpreted in many different ways at lower levels of the state and the party. And it's clear, for example, that the oil industry has an interest in maximizing, its reserves, in kind of pushing a maximal position for the Chinese claim. The fishing industry has the same kind of interests. The coastal provinces, which depend on oil or fishing or whatever, they also have an interest in pushing the maximalist claim. The Navy wants a bigger budget. The Coast Guard wants more ships. So all these lobbies within the Chinese system are pushing for the maximalist claim. But the problem, I think, for China is that China should be in a very strong position in Southeast Asia. In fact, is. It's the biggest economy. All these countries want to trade with China. China wants to trade with them. If it wasn't for the South China Sea, the Chinese situation in Southeast Asia would be fantastic. It's this one issue which trips up most of their other regional ambitions. And what's fascinating to me is that it's the tail wagging the dog. That these South China Sea lobbies seem to be able to upset China's overall interests. I mean, if you think back to 2009, when Obama first went to Beijing, the U.S. was in an incredibly weak position in Asia. You just had the financial crisis. China was in a very strong position. China had just become Malaysia's largest trading partner. You had a very pro-China government in the Philippines. You had Vietnam and China had just finalized their land border agreements, all this kind of stuff. Roll on to the, last year when Obama goes to Beijing. The situation completely changed. Southeast Asian countries have been lobbying to get the US back involved. They're very wary about what China's up to. China's strategic position in Southeast Asia is far weaker than it was. It's managed to alienate the region in a way that wasn't true back in 2009. It's all because of the South China Sea. Why has the leadership not seen that its wider interests lie in a kind of, some kind of regional compromise, because they're being led by this national sense of legitimacy and righteousness, because that's important, I think, to the Communist Party's legitimizing mission. We are the country that we are the power that's going to end the centuries of national humiliation, and we're going to restore China's territory and all this kind of stuff. That seems to be more important than peaceful rise these days.
In your book, you note that some American corporations, such as petroleum companies, have to make a choice. If they wish to do business in China and have access to the market, they have to advance Chinese views with respect to the South China Sea. So is it possible that there are American corporations and actors who are on the Chinese side of this?
It's an interesting one. I mean, I guess businesses will do business whatever, but I mean, in the book I talk about how BP, a British company, was run out of Vietnam because it had much bigger commercial interests in China, which it felt, it was directly told would be at risk if it continued with a project offshore Vietnam. But ExxonMobil, for example, took the opposite position and basically told its Chinese counterparts that it was going to carry on drilling off Vietnam. And because Exxon was in a much stronger position, it was developing gas in Russia, which the Chinese government wanted to import. And so it wasn't able to put anywhere near as much pressure on Exxon. But some other American companies, smaller ones, did pull out of Vietnam and other countries. Interestingly, I just saw today on the internet that Exxon has signed an agreement with the Indonesian oil and gas state company to develop a field near the Natuna Islands, which are and the exclusive economic zone you can draw from Natuna, which is down in the southeastern part of the disputed area, overlaps with the U-shaped line. So it seems that Exxon have basically, maybe they've just seen the result from this arbitration tribunal, the Philippines case, and maybe that's encouraged them. They've now basically signed to develop a project slap bang in the disputed area again. And I think maybe they've made the same calculation that they're, you know, they feel big enough to kind of to see off a Chinese threat there. But who knows? I mean, this may be a big issue, or it, you know, China may just kind of let it go.
We have several questions about the environmental issues posed by the expansion of islands and building up of fragile coral reefs. And one audience member pays you the compliment of saying, nice sneakers.
Sorry, they've been to Yosemite. They would be cleaner if they hadn't been to Yosemite. So China occupies seven reefs or rocks in the Spratly Islands, plus all the ones in the Paracel Islands, which is a relatively small number. I mean, I think Philippines occupies eight or nine, I think. Ten, I'm being prompted. And Vietnam occupies more than half, 28, something like that. Malaysia occupies five. And all countries have built to some extent on these reefs. I mean, Malaysia was one of the first to do a gigantic piece of engineering. There's a Swallow Reef. It's the only one of the Spratlys that you can easily visit. There's actually a civilian diving resort. You can fly there, but there's also a very large concrete airstrip that was built on the reef by the Malaysians. Vietnam expanded some of its work. The Philippines stuck the runway off two ends of Titu Island, Pagasa Island. But what China has done is a kind of, you know, an order of magnitude greater. So, I mean, the new runways are 3 kilometers long, you know, 2.5 miles long. And, you know, I mean, enormous amounts of coral has been, you know, ground up and mixed with concrete and stuck on to make artificial land. And who knows what, you know, there's a guy called John McManus at the University of Miami. He's a coral reef expert. What a great job to have. And he reckons that the Spratly Islands act as a kind of giant spawning ground for the whole of the South China Sea, that fish go there, they reproduce, and then their fry are kind of then washed all around the South China Sea by the ocean currents, and they basically repopulate the stocks. So if you destroy the place where the fish spawn, it's like destroying a salmon lake in the mountains here or something, then you destroy the salmon stock out at sea hundreds or thousands of miles away. It's the same kind of thing is going on. If you destroy the spawning grounds, then, you know, it may take a while, but I mean, we may start to see really major falls in catches all around the region. And I think one of the reasons why China has, for example, it has given its fishing fleets in Hainan and Guangdong province subsidies to build bigger boats with bigger engines to go further afield because waters closer to the shore have been overfished. So the overfishing problem is a major problem. So, and the, add to that the destruction of the habitats. I think, you know, it could be a really bad thing. Now, China did say that it conducted an environmental impact assessment before it did this, but I imagine it was rather short. It's bad, you know. But it'd be nice if we could see it and see if they how much of this they thought.
This audience member states that 86% of China's oil is shipped through the Straits of Malacca, and from the Chinese point of view, the U.S. Navy could cripple China's economy by closing the straits. Uneasy with this vulnerability, isn't China justified with wanting to extend its power?
Yeah, and then, well, I mean, justified or not, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's worth saying that when we talk about Chinese oil imports, that's a relatively small fraction of China's energy needs, which are vastly dominated by coal-fired power stations and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's building nuclear power stations, and it's a massive investor in solar and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, oil has a niche, and most of that oil comes through the Malacca Strait, even when the pipeline through Burma, Myanmar, is fully up and running. That will only take a tiny bite out of it. And this is what I think, you know, this is, I think, where a potential grand bargain could be. But it shows you just how difficult it would be for, I think, to reach an deal. Because, I mean, one of the reasons to build these big runways, I think, I mean, and I think there are many reasons why China is doing it. But one of them, I think, is to project power closer to the Malacca Straits, closer to Singapore, so it can protect trade routes that are coming from the Middle East back to China and try and frustrate any theoretical plan by the US to blockade the strait and starve China into submission. When you hear strategists talking about offshore balancing in the debate about security with China, what they really mean is imposing a trade embargo on China, which sounds kind of preposterous to you know, the world's two biggest trading nations. But I mean, that's kind of what it means. And obviously, this would, I mean, China is much more dependent on food imports and trade than the US is. I mean, I think China's 40% of GDP compared to a third of US GDP is trade, is international trade. And China's been a net food importer for 10 years or something. So they're understandably worried about what a U.S. naval blockade could be. So, I mean, some kind of grand bargain, you know, where for China to accept the status quo would have to include some kind of, you know, understanding that the U.S. would never blockade the Straits of Malacca, that, you know, that China would never invade Taiwan, that the, you know, these kind of, I mean, but these are kind of, these are major, major strategic shifts, which makes me sort of cautious about even suggesting them. But I think that's the kind of scale of deal or understanding that has to be reached to kind of preserve stability in the South China Sea.
The Hague Tribunal that recently ruled, what is the U.S. views on its jurisdiction and what is its ability to actually back up its decision?
Well, the tribunal itself is a curious thing. It's not sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council or anything like that. It's a tribunal which was constituted under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So any country can bring a case against any other signatory in theory. And there are kind of established rules about how it's constituted, but it doesn't have any direct link to the Security Council or UN General Assembly or anything like that. So, and of course, you know, China has a veto on the UN Security Council, and so does Russia, so it's very, very unlikely that the Security Council would take any position on the applicability of this, you know, kind of on the need to observe this ruling. But let me sketch out the doomsday scenario, okay? There's a shallow bit of the South China Sea called the Reed Bank, known as the Recto Bank in the Philippines, which has been well surveyed and is thought to contain 13 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, okay? At the moment, about a third of the electricity in Luzon, in Manila, and the island around Manila, is generated from a gas field called Malampaya, which is in the South China Sea but outside the Chinese claim. That field is due to run out in 10 years' time. Okay, how are they going to keep the lights on in Manila? Okay, they want the gas out of Reed Bank, but the Reed Bank is also within the Chinese claim. This time next year, the Philippines has a legal ruling that says that China has no claim to this area because it's outside these 12 nautical mile circles that I was talking about. So it can send a gas rig out there to drill, and then it can lay a pipeline to connect it to Luzon, and it can continue to generate the electricity, and that's all fine. What happens if China disagrees? Yeah? So the Philippines sends out an oil rig protected by a Coast Guard vessel, and China bashes into the Coast Guard vessel and says, you can't come here. So the Philippines sends out a naval vessel to protect the Coast Guard vessel. Okay. At this point, the U.S. has a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. So the defense treaty does not cover the disputed islands. It only covers the main islands of the Philippines, but it does cover the armed forces. So if China was to attack the Philippines armed forces or the Coast Guard, the U.S. could invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty, okay, and go to war with China for the sake of the Philippines' natural gas resources. Well, all treaties usually have things like mutual consultations, da-da-da-da-da. There's usually a get-out clause. So it's a political decision. And obviously there would be fairly intense discussions between Washington and Manila before any such adventurism took place. So my solution for Middle East peace is that China invests heavily in solar power in the Philippines and leaves the gas in the ground just for now. And then maybe when China has reconciled itself to the fact that it's not going to get the gas out of the Reed Bank, then the Philippines can then go and get it.
We've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and I've tried to go through all of the cards, as is the protocol here at the Commonwealth Club. For the last question, you address this in your book. Virtually all the nations that have some interest here have substantial ethnic Chinese populations. How does that weigh into the balance?
It's an interesting one, and it may become more of an issue, I think, as time goes by. I mean, those Chinese communities have made great efforts to integrate themselves into Southeast Asian societies and not be seen as Chinese implants, if you like. I mean, it's fascinating thing that up until, I think, 1973, someone in the Philippines might correct me, I think Taiwan, the Republic of China, was responsible for the education system of the Chinese community in the Philippines. So the government of the Republic of China ran the schools for the Chinese minority in the Philippines. Yeah? It was only when the Philippines, under Marcos, switched its recognition from Taiwan to Beijing that they realized this wasn't going to work, and those schools were integrated into the Philippine state system. The history of trade and population movement between China and the Philippines is fascinating and immensely interwoven. And you find that most of the people, you know, kind of at the top end of Chinese, of Philippine society, are of Chinese descent in some way, mixed with Spanish, mixed with local indigenous people going way back. But I did a couple of days just going around talking to people in the Chinese area of Manila. And, I mean, not in extensive investigations by any means, but, you know, you find people who just basically, you know, they don't want trouble. They don't want to be identified as Chinese. One person sort of said to me, you know, kind of, if they start the trouble, then I'll support us. But if we start the trouble, I'll support them. But interesting, they is Chinese, we is Philippine people. In Indonesia, the Chinese minority was specifically targeted, you know, at the end of the Suharto regime. You know, they were kind of attacked and there were sort of pogroms against them. They don't want that to happen again. In Malaysia, you can just upset a Chinese Malaysian just simply by asking the question, you know, even to question the idea that they might be somehow more loyal to China than Malaysia, you know, we'll start an argument. But it's also the case, unfortunately, that I think that there are Chinese officials that seek to use the community as a bridgehead and maybe to exploit it. So, and in Malaysia, the Chinese community has been a bridgehead to trade with China and has done very well out of it. And there is some sense that there might be a quid pro quo, and in the run-up, when was it? It was last year, I think, the Chinese ambassador in Malaysia kind of did a walk around sort of the Chinatown in Kuala Lumpur and made some comments about protecting the Chinese minority or something, and that kind of caused a big reaction, kind of, you know, you shouldn't be interfering in our internal affairs. China gets very upset when other countries say anything at all about, you know, minorities inside China. What the hell are you doing? There is, I think, as this diplomatic battle in Southeast Asia about, you know, kind of China's interests and whether China can split Southeast Asia and the ASEAN Association of Southeast Asian Nations, you know, whether this Chinese minority might find itself being pulled in different directions, or suggestions that if you want a trading deal, then you've got to kind of, you know, remember who your ancestors are, kind of thing. So I think it could be a vexed issue, but Southeast Asian Chinese communities that I know anything about don't want it to become one. You know, they want to stay as they are. Yeah.
This has been a fascinating program. Our thanks to Bill Hayton, BBC correspondent and author of the book, The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. We also thank our audiences here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio, television, and the internet. We want to remind everyone in the audience that copies of Mr. Hayton's book are on sale, and he'll be pleased to sign them following the program. I'm Frank Wu, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.